This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Despite a well-researched history of the Jewish genocide during World War II, there are still those who deny the Holocaust ever occurred. One of the most well-known Holocaust deniers today is probably Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Our guest on today's program is Deborah Lipstadt, an author and professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University in Atlanta. She spoke last week at Viterbo University and had a chance to talk about her work with WPR's Steve Roysom.
I have been teaching about the history of the Holocaust for probably 30 years, but my highest profile or greatest notoriety comes from the fact that about 18 years ago, I wrote a book called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. And in that book, I explored the nature of Holocaust denial, who the deniers were, what their modus operandi, what their game plan was, what their aims were. And as a result of that book, which when it came out in the United States and then was bought for publication in the United Kingdom, when it was bought for publication in the United Kingdom, shortly thereafter, I was sued for libel by David Irving, one of the world's leading Holocaust deniers. And that resulted in a three-month trial, which was preceded by close to 3 years of preparation for trial, then a three-month trial, and then a couple of years of appeals and back and forth. And David Irving sued me for libel for calling him a Holocaust denier, even though he was clearly a Holocaust denier. And we exposed his lies in court and won a tremendous victory and really put a stop in great measure to his career as a denier.
First of all, to kind of lay a foundation for the historically challenged, What was the Holocaust?
The Holocaust was the attempt by Nazi Germany, by the Third Reich, to wipe out the Jews of Europe. From Amsterdam to Saloniki, from one end of Europe to the other, and even off Europe, various islands of Crete, northern Africa, Libya, to wipe out as many Jews as they can, as quickly as they can. Now, they also wiped out a good measure of the European gypsy population. It wasn't as comprehensive as the killing of the Jews. And if the Germans had won the war, they probably would have completely wiped out the gypsies and then gone on to wipe out other peoples. In addition to this mass killing of Jews and many, many gypsies, the Germans engaged in all sorts of terrible acts of persecution. Best known amongst them probably is their persecution of German male homosexuals. They didn't try to kill the German homosexuals, but they imprisoned them in horrible circumstances in concentration camps if they did not, quote-unquote, reform their ways. And, of course, their mass murder, the first group they mass murdered, were German, both Jews and even more so non-Jews, handicapped, mentally challenged, mentally deficient, people with genetic diseases or what they interpreted as genetic diseases who did not fit into the picture of the German master race. But we don't, historians don't include those in the Holocaust because that was not a broad genocide. Of course, the handicap, it was came closer to a genocide of the handicap, but it wasn't a genocide of a peoples. And of course, the Germans also murdered millions of Poles and others. But in terms of wiping out a civilian population of the Jews of European Jewry is generally what is referred to as the Holocaust.
I know it was something like 9/11, and I know there's no real comparison if you're looking at body count-wise. Why continue to study the Holocaust instead of simply commemorating it?
To just commemorate without understanding what it was, and more importantly, understanding how it was allowed to come about, would be meaningless. It would be like celebrating July 4th without really understanding what our Constitution is all about and what the history of the revolution against Britain was all about. It would just become a big party, and here it would become just a sad commemoration. But more important is that people understand what it was, and even more importantly, A, that it was committed by people who look no different than you or me. They didn't look like monsters. They didn't act like monsters, except, of course, when they were involved in the killing. For instance, the commandant of Auschwitz would go home to his personal home right on the outskirts of the camp at night and sit with his four children and review their homework, listen to them after they had their violin lessons. We have pictures of him sitting with his family. It looks like a beautiful family portrait. He's in his Nazi uniform and looked like anybody coming home from work, except for the fact that during the day his work was killing. And after the war, there was a tendency to think of the people who were involved in these mass murders and this genocide and these other horrific acts as monsters, as people from a different planet. But they weren't. And I think that's very important in terms of remembering the Holocaust, learning about the Holocaust, and not just commemorating it. The second factor that I think is so important is to understand that the Holocaust didn't emerge fully formed from the forehead of Hitler or any of the people around him. It happened in incremental steps. So it begins with the firing of teachers who are Jews, or the firing of judges who are Jews, or the one-day boycott of Jewish stores, and then various and other sundry laws that constrict Jews' freedom of movement in Germany, and then disenfranchising them as citizens in 1935, limiting where they could live, and all sorts of other things, making them ultimately wear a yellow star, marking them as Jews. But it didn't start with the killings. It started with things that were relatively small things that the rest of the German populace accepted freely and supported because they were great supporters of Hitler. It's a myth to think that the Hitlerian regime was imposed upon the Germans. They welcomed it.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Steve Reisom. We're talking with Professor Deborah Lipstead from Emory University in Atlanta on the day we are recording this. She is giving two talks at Viterbo University here in La Crosse. The first is on the Holocaust denial, which she says is a form of anti-Semitism. Are there people out there who deny the Holocaust completely? And if so, why is that a bad thing?
Well, first of all, to deny history is a bad thing. To deny things that evidently happened in history. If someone came into this room and denied that World War II ever happened, you would think they were crazy, you would think they were nuts, and you wouldn't want them certainly teaching your children or exposed to your children. The people who deny the Holocaust are not just crazy, but they also have a motive of anti-Semitism. Because they don't just deny, but they say this didn't happen. The Jews made it up. They made it up for their own personal advantage and to blacken the name of Nazi Germany, to enhance their power, and to get the sympathy of the world. So there's a motive to their denial. The Holocaust has the dubious distinction of being the best documented genocide in the world. There are more documents by the perpetrators. The perpetrators were convicted at Nuremberg, were completely convicted on their own documents, on what they had said and written and dictated and about what they did and what they were doing. So to deny something that is so well documented and so extensive, where the perpetrators said, I did it, but I was following orders. I did it, but I didn't give the order to do it. I just followed orders, is just ludicrous.
Is Holocaust denial more prominent now than it has been?
I don't know if it's more prominent, but I think my concern, I don't want your listeners to think that Holocaust denial is a clear and present danger. I think it's a clear and future danger, in that as people who experience the Holocaust, as survivors die off, as the voice of the person who can speak in the first person singular, I was there, this is what happened to me, this is what happened to my family. As those voices become fewer and far between, as those voices are stilled by the biological clock of aging and death, I think that there'll be more and more of a tendency to deny, and deniers will use that opportunity.
I want to touch on both your books, and I'll choose the new one coming out actually first, and we'll go back to David Irving. The new book coming out, the Eichmann trial.
Right.
Who was Adolf Eichmann, and what should historians take away from his trial?
Adolf Eichmann was one of the chief operating officers of the Final Solution of the murder of European Jewry. He wasn't the architect. He wasn't involved in all aspects of the Final Solution. But at his hand, probably 1.5 million Jews were deported, sent to camps, chased down. He was industrious. He was committed to this task. He was ingenious. He did this with a relatively small staff. He was a committed anti-Semite, and he did this with great gusto. After the war, when his name came up at the Nuremberg trials, his assistant spoke about his role, and his associate spoke about his role, he knew he had to get out of Germany, so he escaped to Argentina under a false name, possibly with the cooperation of the Red Cross and the Vatican. And he lived in Argentina under a pseudonym. The Argentinians probably knew who he was, and certainly other Nazis who had escaped to Argentina also knew who he was. But in 1960s, the Israelis were made aware that he was 1960 or late 1959 were made aware that he was there, the pseudonym under which he was living. And in May of 1960, a group of Israelis went to Argentina, captured him, kidnapped him, and snuck him out of Argentina on an Israeli airline. They brought him to Israel. And Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, who knew this, who obviously had given the green light for this operation, and who could have said to the men who went to Argentina, just kill him, just murder him, let him die from a bullet walking home from work and disappear and get out of there. But David Ben-Gurion understood the importance of bringing him to Israel and having a trial, which would expose his wrongs and make known his wrongs and the story of the final solution. So he was brought to Israel, and about 11 months later, in April 1961, he was put on trial in Jerusalem. And his wrongs were exposed very extensively. But one of the striking things and probably most important legacies of the Eichmann trial was the witnesses. Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor, decided to bring in survivors who could tell the story of what happened. So you had a procession, so to speak, a sequence of survivors telling the story in full detail. And people saw that they didn't look they looked like normal people. They didn't look like people who were meek or who would allow something terrible to happen to them, but that these were people who had no choice. They were forced into this terrible situation and had many cases had no chance of escape or fighting back. And the survivors had spoken about what happened to them before, but as a result of this trial, with the world's attention on Jerusalem, there were more reporters for the opening of the Eichmann trial than had been in Nuremberg for the opening of the Nuremberg tribunals. With this attention, the survivors gained what some specialists have called and historians have called semantic authority, that their words were listened to. And it became clear in the fact that after that, at all subsequent war crimes trial pertaining to World War II, but other war crimes trials too, Cambodia, Rwanda, the former Yugoslavia, that you never had a trial without the voice of the victim, that you had to have that first person singular to make clear what happened to them.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Steve Reisom. Along with us is Deborah Lipstadt, a professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University in Atlanta. As we record this on the stage, he is giving two talks at Viterbo University. Let's get back to David Irving. You mentioned him at the beginning of this interview. Give us a little bit of background, and also this is a story that you very much ended up being in at a point.
Well, in my first book on Holocaust denial, I devoted maybe a page and a half at most, to a man named David Irving. David Irving was the author of a number of works on history, particularly history of World War II, well-written, seemingly extensively documented. And in the late 1980s, he became a Holocaust denier. He adopted Holocaust denial, probably as a way of getting attention. He became very active as a denier. And in my book on Holocaust denial, I mentioned David Irving as the most dangerous of Holocaust deniers, because unlike other deniers who were only known for being deniers, he had a reputation that was separate and apart. He had an independent reputation. So when he became a denier, people said, oh, that's interesting. Some people said, well, I don't believe that the Holocaust didn't happen, but maybe there really weren't gas chambers, or I don't believe the Holocaust didn't happen, but maybe there really weren't 6 million or whatever it was. And Irving, of course, claimed to have proof of all these things, that he wasn't just saying this, but he had scientific proof, he had documentary proof. When my book was published, shortly thereafter, the rights were bought by Penguin UK, and it was published in the United Kingdom, and David Irving chose to sue me for libel. I didn't sue him, he sued me. And the reason he waited till the book came out in England to sue me is that British libel laws favor plaintiff. Or the put it this way, in America, if I say you libeled me, you said things about me that are not true, I have to prove you said things about me that weren't true, that what you said was not true. In England, if I said you libeled me by what you said about me or wrote about me, you as the author have to prove the truth of what you said. So it's a flip. It's a mirror image of the United States, which meant that I was responsible for fighting, for proving the truth of what I said, which is why even though I was counseled by many people, including Holocaust historians, to just ignore him, they said, oh, Holocaust denial is a stupid topic. It's silly. It's like flat earth theorists. Who fights the flat earth theorists? Just forget them. Brush them aside. I knew that if I didn't fight David Irving, he would win by default. I would lose. I would be because I hadn't shown up, and he would win by default. And then he could say, I am not a Holocaust denier. Deborah Lipstadt was found to have libeled me when she called me a Holocaust denier. Ipso facto, my David Irving's version of the Holocaust is the legitimate version. And he says there were no gas chambers, there weren't 6 million killed, the Germans didn't plan to kill the Jews, and, quote, Hitler was the best friend the Jews had in Germany. And I couldn't let that just stand without being challenged.
And how did the court rule?
The court ruled after a over 3 month trial, the court ruled that David Irving was a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, a racist. He says terrible things about people of color, particularly black people. He was a racist, a Holocaust denier, and a liar. It was a devastating judgment for him. One of the newspapers said history has had its day in court and scored a crushing victory. One of the important things about my trial is to recognize that we weren't in the courtroom to prove the Holocaust happened. We didn't think that was necessary. There's so much documentation proving that it happened. Our objective was to demonstrate that when deniers say, I can prove that gas chambers would have blown up, or I can prove that Hitler didn't want the Jews killed, or I can prove the Jews were never killed in this place, that the proof they offer doesn't support what they're saying. And nobody had ever followed their footnotes before. People knew they were lying, but nobody had ever figured out exactly how and what they were doing. We followed their footnotes back to the sources. And not in most cases, and not in the preponderance of cases, but in every single case where we traced something David Irving said about the Holocaust back to its source, we found a lie, a distortion, an invention, an inversion of characters, of dates, something that turned what was really being said on its head.
Looking back at the study of Holocaust, first of all, how did you get into it? As you know, you went to college, you picked a major.
Right.
Here you are, a couple of years after college, and
what led me to study this?
What led you to study, and how can you study something like this without having more than your share of outrage?
First of all, let me answer how I came to study this. Answer first in the negative. I'm not a child of Holocaust survivors. No one in my immediate family died in the Holocaust. But as I learned about the Holocaust, I became entirely intrigued that something like this could happen in the 20th century. And then when I was an undergraduate, I went to Israel and I met many survivors there. And that also gave me a different exposure to what had happened. But the thing that really changed for me was in 1972, early in my graduate school career, I went to the Soviet Union. And I went to the Soviet Union to meet what we used to call refuseniks, Jews who were trying to get out of the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union would not let them out. And I met them because they were Jews. I met these people who were trying to live a Jewish life under the thumb of the KGB, under the thumb of oppression, being thrown into jail for teaching Hebrew. And I saw how brave they were. And I saw how they were fighting to live Jewish lives. And many of them had family who had been victims of the Holocaust. And I just came out and I was so intrigued and outraged. I did have my share of outrage. Outraged by the anti-Semitism I had encountered that I began to study it. Now, how can you study something like this and not become outraged? Sometimes you do become outraged. But if you're going to do the proper kind of study, if you're going to do the proper kind of analysis, and it doesn't matter what aspect of the Holocaust you're going to study, if you let your outrage intrude on your historical analysis, you're doing no one a favor. You're not doing your readers a favor. You're not doing your students a favor. The necessity is to put aside that outrage and study the facts. The facts speak for themselves. You don't have to put yourself into it emotionally. In fact, you have to take yourself out of it.
Are you Jewish?
Yes, I am.
Have you come across, because of your studies, because of the books, because of the talks like you're giving at Viterbo University, have you received accolades? I know that's probably not what why you're doing what you're doing, but have you seen your fair share of accolades for pursuing Holocaust denials?
Yes, and you know, I've received a fair share of accolades. When I first began, I received a fair share of skepticism from my academic colleagues who thought I was wasting my time. Why am I studying? They said,
really?
If you were an earth scientist, would you be studying flat earth theorists? Because they just looked at these people as ridiculous. And they said, why are you wasting your time? And I even had people who told me, don't fight the case. Let it just go. No one will pay attention to them anyway. After the trial, some of those people came and apologized and said they were wrong. But the accolades that I received in the extreme, and the ones that to this day, a decade after the trial, still make me entirely uncomfortable, are the accolades and the thanks, not even accolades, but the thanks, the profound thanks that I received from survivors and from survivors' children. And I would always say to them, and I still say to them, don't thank me. What you went through was so much more extreme than what I did. But to them, here, they remember the years of the Holocaust. They experienced the years of the Holocaust. If their parents went through it, they know it from their parents' stories. And one of the things that is most disturbing to them about the Holocaust, almost over and above the terrible things the Germans did, is that the rest of the world, quote unquote, let this happen. That no one seemed to care, that no one stopped it. And now they look, and 40 years later, 40 years after the Holocaust, here is someone, a woman, standing up to not the Nazis, but to the heirs of the Nazis. David Irving is a great fan of the Third Reich and of Adolf Hitler, and fighting back. And even though the battle that I fought, the legal battle I fought, can in no manner, shape, or form compare to what they went through, it's a feeling that at long last someone is fighting back and addressing these lies. And they have thanked me, and it's uncomfortable when they do, but it's tremendously moving as well.
Deborah Lipstadt is an author and professor of Jewish and Holocaust Studies at Emory University in Atlanta. She was in La Crosse last week, speaking at Viterbo University. Lipstadt was interviewed by WPR's Steve Roysom. Coming up in the next half hour, what it's like to be young and Arab in the U.S. post-9/11. I'll talk with the author of a book that attempts to answer that question. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. We also welcome your comments and ideas. Simply follow the links on our archives page at wpr.org/lacrosse.